Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So here's a switch. At the two conventions, the Democratic Party talked more about war and troops than the Republicans did. Joining us to talk about this and to fact check at least one of the president's claims from last night is Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times and WNYC contributor David Sanger. His new book is Confront and Conceal: Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David, hi.
Great to be back with you, Brian.
So in case you didn't notice, there was a big speech last night.
I heard.
In Charlotte, North Carolina. Let's go over a couple of the foreign policy and national security topics that he addressed. And we noticed that in today's times, you fact check this particular statement.
4 years ago, I promised to end the war in Iraq. We did. I promised to refocus on the terrorists who actually attacked us on 9/11. And we have. We've blunted the Taliban's momentum in Afghanistan, and in 2014, our longest war will be over. A new tower rises above the New York skyline. Al-Qaeda is on the path to defeat, and Osama bin Laden is dead.
So that was about 33 seconds of context, his war on terror passage. The part of that that you picked out to fact check was the line, in 2014, our longest war will be over. True or false?
That one's largely false. Let's run through his list. Are we out of Iraq? Absolutely. There may be slightly over 100 Americans left in Iraq. Iraq may still be a cauldron of political intrigue, but we're out. Had the U.S. focused anew on terrorism? Did, and in a much smarter way. And you heard a lot about bin Laden, and you heard Vice President Biden repeat the bumper sticker line he has been running around the country with, which is bin Laden's dead and General Motors is alive. And that was clearly one of the big themes I wanted to hit last night. They're absolutely right on that. On the question of blunting the momentum of the Taliban, the jury is still out on that. And whether in 2014 our longest war will be over, well, frankly, Brian, if you listen to the White House itself, what they tell you they would like to have is what you call an enduring presence in Afghanistan. Now, what is that enduring presence? What I wrote in Confront and Conceal, based on interviews that I had done with people in the military, people in the administration, was that they like 10,000 to 15,000 troops to be staying behind high walls, largely, in Afghanistan beyond the withdrawal date of the end of 2014. They may be there indefinitely. I mean, the idea is to have a presence the way we have a presence in Europe or in South Korea. And what's it there to do? To keep the Taliban from toppling Kabul and the leadership. Harder for them to do if they know an American combat force is still living in the country. And to keep an eye on Pakistan and its nuclear weapons. In other words, to use Afghanistan as the base to contain Pakistan, while we did most of the war the other way around, using Pakistan as a way into Afghanistan. So on that issue, if you listen to his own aides, we're not going to be completely out. And, you know, the war won't be over. Our participation in it will be greatly reduced.
What would it mean in practical terms to have maybe 15,000 American troops behind high walls, as you put it, in an insurgency kind of war like the Taliban is fighting against the Afghan government? When you look at the North Korea-South Korea analogy, that's one big country in the north, there's a border, and there's another big country in the south. You can put troops around the border, and, you know, it's a binary thing. Very different in Afghanistan. So how does that presence actually dissuade the Taliban, unless those Americans are, in fact, willing to get out? And I think the Petraeus model is that they would have to use some kind of overwhelming force, at least from town to town, one at a time, in order to have an impact.
Well, I think the concept is that by that time they would not be going town to town. You know, I think that while no politician is willing to go say it in the midst of this, I think the concept is that the Afghan military can probably hold on to most of the major cities, not necessarily all of them. But the rural areas are going to be very hard because there's very little Afghan military presence there, and it's ripe for the Taliban coming back in. And clearly, with 10,000 to 15,000 people, you don't do a counterinsurgency operation. The U.S. hasn't been able to do true classic counterinsurgency even with 100,000 there and another 30,000 or 40,000 of foreign troops, most of whom are packing up and going home as well. So all it is a tripwire, and that is why it is more like the South Korea example. The American troops in South Korea are there to send a message to the North Koreans to say, if you decide to come in and do something dramatic, you're going to have to deal with these guys. And so it's there as a deterrent. As you say, it's a lot riskier in Afghanistan because you don't have the clear demarcation. The second issue you have is that they're clearly going to be running missions into Pakistan. And remember, the big strategic threat, as we've discussed before these days, is really in Pakistan. It's not in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, the concern is, could al-Qaeda reconstitute? Seems unlikely right now. In Pakistan, you've got an active insurgency, a weak government, and 100 nuclear weapons.
In fact, one of the other big stories this week that we hadn't talked about, and I noticed this was the lead story on the public radio program The World yesterday, Pakistan kicking out some foreign workers from the humanitarian group Save the Children because of a way that they may have introduced somebody from Pakistan to the CIA in a way that led to the United States getting Osama bin Laden. Are you aware of this?
I've seen a little bit of the report, and you know, I don't understand the details of who they introduced and not, but it is related to this allergy that they have around the doctor, Dr. Afridi, who was part of the bin Laden search team. Maybe you'll remember that Afridi, who's now being held, has been put on trial, was the guy who was trying an inoculation program in that neighborhood in Abbottabad in an effort to try to get the DNA of bin Laden or others in the family to confirm that that was, in fact, bin Laden there. What's remarkable about this is that you have a Pakistan government, an alleged ally, who has spent far more energy in tracking down people who might have helped the CIA locate bin Laden than they ever put into the effort of locating bin Laden. And I think that alone tells you everything you need to know about how incredibly complex and frustrating the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan has become. It's become more complex this morning with Secretary Clinton's decision just a few hours ago, which we reported earlier on in the Times, to designate the Haqqani network, which is in Pakistan, a terrorist network. And that is something that the Pakistan government has been opposing doing for some time.
What does the United States get by making a formal designation?
Well, it makes it a little bit easier to freeze out finances to squeeze the Haqqani network. The difficulty is that the Haqqani network has long been an arm of the ISI, the intelligence service, and as a result, the Pakistani intel services have viewed them as part of the hedge in case the Taliban end up taking over in Afghanistan, and they want the Haqqani network as sort of a way that they can continue to exercise influence along the border areas. So this is just another area where the U.S. and the Pakistanis simply can't get on the same page.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with David Sanger from the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. We have a war in Afghanistan fact check from David in the New York Times today, and we're talking about that with respect to the Obama speech last night and looking at Romney and Obama convention foreign policy moments. Generally, if anybody wants to weigh in on that with a comment or a question, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And David, somebody did post on our website saying these deadlines for withdrawal from Iraq, which Obama took credit for in the clip we played, actually were negotiated during the Bush administration. And with respect to Obama saying our longest war, Afghanistan, will soon be over, the listener asked, wasn't the Cold War the longest war? So let's take Iraq first. Is it really Bush who should get the credit for negotiating that withdrawal?
Bush did negotiate that withdrawal, and President Obama stuck with the schedule. What's interesting is that it's Governor Romney who has argued that President Obama erred by withdrawing too fast and that the U.S. has lost influence there. So this is a case where you would put Bush and Obama in the same boat and Romney in a different boat. Now, he has not said how he would have dealt with the problem that ultimately led with the U.S. withdrawing all forces, which was that the Iraqi government wouldn't give immunity to the U.S. forces, meaning they could be prosecuted under Iraqi law, something that the U.S. Military never permits, around the world. And since they couldn't negotiate that, Obama decided to have everybody leave. On the second question that they raised on the longest war, if he would accurately have said the longest hot war. But the Cold War certainly was longer, but you did not see large number of casualties or a large number of standing troops in harm's way. You saw standing troops
yes.
in Europe.
So it may not be apples to oranges, but maybe it's Macintosh to Granny Smith.
Something like that.
I think we should mention the Democratic Party platform problem this week with respect to designating Jerusalem the capital of Israel. It was not in when it had been in previously. Then there was even more controversy after Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, who was the chair of the convention, called for a voice vote of the platform committee to put that language back in with the very strong urging of President Obama. The voice vote took three tries and encountered strong opposition from Democratic delegates, and according to most people's hearings of the tape, it didn't even really pass on the third vote, even though he declared it passed. What actually happened there, and what does it actually mean for Israel?
I think it was for what it means for Israel, probably nothing, but it was a political screw-up, I think, in the by the Democratic Committee, by the White House's own assessment. I mean, when you have the President of the United States urging a change in the platform, tells you that the White House had not properly vetted the platform or didn't have influence enough over the people who were writing it, and then they had to force through this change. What they did was mess with the wording, which has long established that Jerusalem should be the capital of Israel, but also has the wording then saying that there should be a negotiated settlement about the full status of Jerusalem, which, of course, is contested by, all parties. And if you go back to President Clinton's effort to try to strike a deal in the late 90s and in the last Camp David meeting in 2000, it all broke down over status of Jerusalem issues. And it has remained a sore spot ever since. I think that those Republicans who want to make the argument that President Obama does not have Israel's back as much as he says he does will leap upon this. And I think it helps explain why President Obama had in his speech last night the statement that the U.S. remains an incredibly firm backer of Israel as an ally.
Do you think that it was omitted from the platform as a matter of oversight, or because somebody in the administration or somebody in the Democratic platform committee wanted to make a statement that we're not just taking Israel's side in the platform, better not to mention either side than to look one-sided or something like that?
I suspect the latter, but I have not been involved in the reporting about how it got omitted. I stayed in Washington. I was not in Charlotte during the convention, and so I don't know how that got taken out. But I would assume it was taken out somewhat deliberately because it takes more effort to take something out than just leave it from past time.
And why hasn't any U.S. president actually taken the step of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem if Israel calls Jerusalem its capital, even President Bush?
President Bush didn't do it, but neither Republicans nor Democrats have done it. And the reason is that it would seem to take the United States out of its effort to act as something of a neutral arbiter in trying to step in and help come up with a decision between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
So the U.S. is still walking this line always between being a neutral arbiter and being a strong supporter of Israel.
That's right. That's right. And so the trick is being a strong supporter of Israel's right to exist and the defense of the state, but trying to be a neutral arbiter on the question of boundaries and how you create a two-state solution.
Has Romney made that promise explicitly that he would move the embassy?
I've heard him talk about Jerusalem as the true capital. I've not heard him say whether or not he would move the embassy, but it's entirely possible I missed it.
Let's get another Afghanistan question in from Bob in Brooklyn. Bob, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi there, Brian. Hello, David.
Hello.
I would like to discuss the situation regarding Afghanistan and China. What's not being discussed is the close proximity of Afghanistan to China. You know, President Obama has talked about his concerns about China, militarily speaking. I'm of the opinion that maybe the National Security Agency wants to maintain permanent military bases in Afghanistan to use as eavesdropping bases to keep an eye on China, not only aircraft reconnaissance, but ground-based electronic eavesdropping bases. And that's why they may want to keep a permanent military base there.
That's really interesting. And I think one of the underreported facts of the Obama administration is that they also opened a base and sent a few troops to Australia, right, David? And that has to do with keeping an eye on China.
Well, let's start with Australia, then move to Afghanistan.
And by the way, we have 2 minutes left.
Sure. In Australia, we've had the biggest NSA collection agent area and huge antennas in the middle of the country for years on end. The floating base, and it's not even a permanent base in Australia, is part of this effort to sort of refocus on the Pacific and counter the Chinese in the South China Sea. In Afghanistan, it's more complex. The U.S. has got a lot of intelligence interests in Afghanistan, and only a piece of them are about China. The biggest ones are about Pakistan and Iran. And for that purpose, I'm certain that they probably want to keep some territory. But you can have an intel base without having an extraordinarily large military presence.
And there we leave it with David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and WNYC contributor. His new book is Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
And by the way, folks, in case you're interested, I'll be talking more convention politics and other things on television tonight as a member of the New York One Reporters Roundtable. That's around 7:30 and 10:30 tonight on New York One. Coming up next right here, not the Yankees collapse, not the Andy Roddick retirement, what's been thrilling at the Paralympics. Stay with us.